Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's program. I'm Marcus Peter. This hour we will be joined, as we are every Thursday, by Dr. Matthew Bunsen, a friend who will walk with us through a lot of the events in church news right now. We will evaluate events around the world in light of the faith and ultimately to draw out the Catholic story of all of this. And one of the main things is that the Knights of Columbus announced today, actually, that it would cover mosaics by the accused abuser, Father Marco Rupnik, in Washington, D.C. and Connecticut. And this is a dramatic move. This is crucial, actually, that they've taken this stride, because it represents so far the strongest public stand yet by a major Catholic organization regarding the former Jesuits' embattled and, frankly, potentially scandalous art, given the reality of what was happening in the background in his own personal life during the making of all of that art. Matthew Bunsen will join us with more on this and other church news, including the talking about the new Instrumentum Laboris, which focuses on how to implement the goals of the Synod on Synodality. And once this Instrumentum Laboris is adopted, what does it look like for the Synod moving forward in the October sessions? So we'll be able to talk about all of this. And I want to announce some things to all of you. Firstly, tomorrow will be the last day of the airing of Cresta in the Afternoon. After 27 years, we are retiring that program, this program, as we have bid farewell to our beloved Al Cresta, who was my mentor for the past 5 years. On Monday, we begin a new program entitled Ave Maria in the Afternoon, and I am blessed to be the host of that program. It will continue along the vein of a lot of what Al taught me over the past 5 years, which is speaking the truths of the faith and the scriptures into the heart of the culture. So for tomorrow's program, we want to invite you in the second hour, which is this hour, to call in one of the segments, and we'll announce that, about your favorite books that Al mentioned to you on Cresta in the Afternoon. Over 27 years, Al recommended tens of thousands of books to you, and we'd like to hear about them and how they impacted your life. More on that later. I'll announce a little bit more. For now, the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, July 11th. It's the feast of St. Benedict of Nursia. Today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. The Knights of Columbus will cover mosaics by accused abuser Father Marco Rupnik in Washington, D.C. and Connecticut. Supreme Knight Patrick Kelly telling EWTN that the artwork will be covered with cloth in the near future, and a more permanent cover may be installed following the conclusion of the Vatican investigation into Rupnik, who is accused of serious spiritual, psychological, and sexual abuse of as many as 30 religious sisters. Matthew Bunsen has more in today's program. Former President Trump will soon announce his running mate in the 2024 election. The former president telling Fox News' Brian Kilmeade show that he'll unveil his pick over the next week. Top potential picks include North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. As there's calls from fellow Democrats to exit the presidential race, President Biden plans to host a high-stakes news conference today. It comes after the president's interview with ABC News did little to ease concerns over whether he can defeat Donald Trump and serve another term. The event comes as the New York Times reports the Biden campaign is testing how Vice President Harris would match up against Donald Trump in the general election. And the FBI is highlighting a milestone for a key investigation tool.
The agency marked the 100th anniversary of its fingerprinting technology during a ceremony at its West Virginia branch on Wednesday. The Bureau established its Identification Division, or IDENT, back in 1924. It was tasked with using prints from law enforcement agencies across the country in order to connect the dots on cases. The FBI saying that it used to take weeks to find matches. Now, it takes seconds. I'm Matt Mattinson.
And I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me for this hour is our friend and colleague, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, Senior Fellow at St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and the author or co-author of more than 50 titles. You can follow him and his prolific work on Twitter at Matt Bunsen, and you can listen to him on Register Radio, which airs Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio. Matthew, it's not like we have plenty to talk about today.
We always do.
We always do. So I think let's cover the Rupnik situation, because the Instrumentum Laboris warrants quite a bit of examination. So it's good that the Knights of Columbus are taking this step, because they're the first major Catholic organization globally to declare that they're going to do this. And it might just spark a movement of doing stuff like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you and I have even talked over the last weeks about the question of what to do with Marco Rupnik's art. And it matters for two reasons. One, the prominence of Father Rupnik in the art world, but also apparently in ecclesiastical circles, former Jesuit, at one point excommunicated. But the other aspect is that his art, whatever one thinks of it and whatever one thinks should be done with it, is everywhere in the church. We see it even today on the Vatican website, for example. We see his artwork decorating massive amounts of liturgical space all over the world, mm-hmm. including Lourdes. You and I talked about that, I know. And one of the more prominent spaces that it has been festooning for some time is the John Paul II Shrine here in Washington, D.C., the John Paul II National Shrine, basically the chapel. There are two chapels where the mosaics cover floor to ceiling at the shrine. And the knights who run the shrine itself have been debating for some time, I know, what to do with them. A lot of different locations, 200-plus places around the world that are decorated with his artwork. And so today, Patrick Kelly, the Supreme Knight of the Knights, in an appearance at EWTN News and then in a press release as well, came up an announcement with what they're going to do about it. And as you said, this is a decision to cover from floor to ceiling mosaics with cloth. And it's a decision, I think, we can talk more about this in a second, but I think it's an interesting decision of, it's a temporary solution.
Yep.
Taking the first steps toward what could be a permanent resolution or a permanent decision about it. But it's a decision that makes sense prudentially, because it at least covers them mm-hmm. until the completion of what's happening right now, which is a formal investigation into all of the allegations of abuse. And there are many of them against
That's right.
Father Rupnik.
That's right. Over a dozen women over the course of about two decades. So we've got issues, like you mentioned, that have to be dealt with in a prudent manner, and they call for sound prudential judgments. I would say that the act of covering them in this way is the first step in the longer journey of making these sound decisions, because the removal of this artwork is going to bring with it a hefty price tag.
But yes.
At some point, some decision needs to be made.
It does. But it also, it does two things that were really quite striking. And again, I have to credit Patrick Kelly, the Supreme Knight, and the Knights themselves in reaching this. The first, as you say, is this is a temporary, prudent decision in order to remove them from public gaze. In other words, to remove them from the possibility of causing scandal, controversy, but also, as the Knights, I noticed in their press release and the things that Patrick Kelly said today to EWTN News, that the goal here is to end any possible trauma or pain that could be caused mm-hmm. To the victims of abuse who come upon this art. That has certainly been in the discussion in Lourdes. Bishop Mikad of Lourdes has mentioned several times that part of this pondering, this discernment, is the possible pain and anguish that this art can cause.
Right.
But the other is that it then allows for careful study as to what is going to happen to this art. Yes, they could walk in with a series of hammers and screwdrivers or other things and just tear the art off the walls, but you would be quite literally destroying it.
That's right.
Is that the decision? Is that what you want to do with this? And it raises a host of questions about what to do with controversial art. But this also then allows for a very considered decision to be made about if the time comes that it has to be gone, what does that look like? What is the best way to proceed? So all of this is taken care of, at least in the short term, by covering them over with this this cloth.
Right. And as you mentioned, controversial art, because therein lies the problem. The art itself isn't scandalous, but the circumstances surrounding the creation of the art and even the artist, highly questionable. The Jesuits themselves found the reason why he was expelled was because they found the allegations to be credible. And the investigation that's ongoing could well prove that. And so these are things that truly need to be taken into consideration, because the victims could well continue in their trauma by witnessing the celebration of his public work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And here the Knights, too, are following again in the footsteps of Bishop Mikaz and in Lourdes in proceeding carefully with prudence, but after a great deal of discernment. In this case, the Knights made the point that this decision came at the end of what they described as a very comprehensive, very confidential process. And what did it include? It meant consultations with the abuse victims themselves, as well as art historians, which is a somewhat underappreciated aspect to all of this, because regardless of what one's opinion might be of Rupnik and his art, and people have very strong opinions about Rupnik and his art, this is still a very prominent and highly influential artist in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yep.
There is a reason why his art has appeared, his mosaics have appeared so prominently and for so long in so much liturgical art, in churches, in booklets, on book covers, you name it. His art is there.
Yeah.
And so he, whether we like it or not, or whatever one's opinion of him, he holds a very prominent place. So art historians then should be consulted, and have been, about what is the potential impact here and what message are we sending. And then they've also talked to bishops and various moral theologians, and that's what he approached, because there's that spiritual dimension to making this decision as well.
Yep. And God bless them as they continue these deliberations, because regardless of the outcome of the investigations, quite a lot of damage has already been done, not just to the victims, but also to the reputation of the art itself. No one's ever going to be able to look upon this art and think, gosh, this is wonderful, without remembering the stigma behind it.
That's right. Yeah, there will always be attached to this, I think you've used the right word, stigma. At the very least, there's going to be this controversy. Now, we've noted as well that the comparison has been made. I use the phrase, the Caravaggio comparison.
That's right.
To someone like Caravaggio, this Renaissance painter who at one point killed a man in a brawl under what were described historically as very seedy, tawdry circumstances. He had a violent temper. His personality was one that could be intemperate. It could be hot. And yet, his art has withstood the test of time. Now, the question is, can you make that comparison between Caravaggio and Marco Rupnik? And I think, and there are a lot of art historians that I've talked to who say, no, it's a false comparison, because Caravaggio's artwork never was designed or built or implemented in a way that was a direct reflection of his scandalous behavior.
Yep.
In the case of Marco Rupnik, in fact, the allegations have been very clear from many of the alleged victims of abuse at his hands that he did, in fact, incorporate very heavily the aspects of his abuse into his art.
Yep. And again, you know, the Jesuits found this credible, which means that regardless of how you feel about the beauty of the art, once you recognize that fact, that art ceases to convey messages of truth, beauty, and goodness, and it starts conveying the ugliness of what was going on behind the intention of the artist.
Yeah, the phrase has been used that it conveys a false gospel. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting turn of phrase, but I think based on the allegations, certainly that the, many of the alleged victims would argue that point precisely.
So I'd like to pivot now, and hopefully we can continue to pray for the Knights of Columbus and actually the global community, global Catholic community, to discern well what to do with everywhere that his art has showed up. Let's talk about the Instrumentum Laboris. So this is a document that follows the document, and it's a proposition for the next document to be signed on the Synod on Synodality.
Well, that's right. So all synods have some kind of a working document. And we have been waiting for months for the blueprint, so to speak, this roadmap for the second session of the Synod on Synodality that will be held in October. This instrumentum, however, once it was published just a few days ago, is very striking in how radically different it is from the first one, from last year's. And this is the living proof, I think, of two things that came to mind immediately when I read it. The first is that nothing ever really happens in total isolation. Mm-hmm. So when we start at the end of last year's synod and work our way into the new year and then through spring and then to the release of this document, that much has changed really from the end of that first session to today. Changed in particular because Pope Francis shifted so much of the focus of the work of the synod away from what were described frequently as controversial or hot-button issues toward a very much sharper focus on synodality itself
that's
and the life of the Church. But that's the second key point here, that the task for those who are going to be participating isn't to talk about these topics of controversy. It is to be focused on synodality. And that changes very significantly, not just the deliberations that we can expect, but what that final document that would ultimately be presented to the Holy Father will look like. And then lurking in the background, and we can talk more about this in a second, are those 10 working groups were charged by Pope Francis with taking on the discussion about the theological and moral questions that were raised in that first session.
Right. Well, thank you, Matthew. We will continue this conversation on the other side of the break. My guest is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we are right now talking about the guiding document that's been put out for the final part of the Synod on Synodality, which was published on Tuesday. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
The Church isn't saying throw out the baby with the bathwater. Throw out all the media. Don't use the media. What the Pope is saying that make sure that what you are doing is enabling yourself and others to encounter Christ more deeply. And you can't do that unless you reach out. You have to reach out to God first. You have to encounter Him in the Eucharist in that personal relationship. And then you pray, you reflect, and then you go. In my book, Beyond Sunday, Becoming a 24/7 Catholic, I talk about the three M's of faith: meeting, mercy, and mission. You meet and encounter Christ. You enter into a personal relationship with Him. He gives you mercy. And then what do? You just sit there and say, oh, thanks, Jesus. See you later. No, you go out on mission exactly as the woman at the well did.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
What are the three parables Jesus tells about prayer in St. Luke's Gospel? The first is what the Catechism calls the importunate friend. This is the friend who wakes a pal at midnight in order to borrow three loaves of bread to feed a visitor. The second parable the Catechism labels the importunate widow, who persistently pleads for her rights from a reluctant judge till the wearied judge rules in her favor. This parable illustrates the need to pray always and with the patience of faith. Jesus closes this parable with the poignant question, "When the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith on the earth?" The third parable centers on the Pharisee and the tax collector, commending the tax collector for his humility because he asked God to be merciful to me, a sinner, a prayer which the church adopts as its own. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me for this hour is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We are right now talking about the guiding document for the final part on synodality, which was published Tuesday. It's the Instrumentum Laboris. So, Matthew, we were talking earlier about how the document actually does steer clear of a lot of those hot-button issues because Pope Francis, in his wisdom, elected those 10 study groups, and they're going to continue their work well past the Synod meeting in October, and we'll get the results of that in terms of another document and another report that will come out. But this Instrumentum Laboris, as you mentioned, is pretty sharp on its focus. It's very clear that the language here is we need to build a synodal church, and we're going to keep discovering what building a synodal church means and looks like.
That's right. It's something of a reality for all of us that for many Catholics, many Catholics, it is still very difficult to define what exactly synodality is. And this has been a challenge for the Holy Father. It has been a challenge for certainly the Synod on Synodality itself. And so in this new Instrumentum Laboris, once again, the whole front part of it is constructed around trying once again to provide a working definition of what synodality means, but especially how is it going to be lived in the church. And we see, once again, the traditional phrases like accompaniment and listening. And from that, then, it springs out into the various sections, built as it always is around sort of three themes. They have things like relationships. It has pathways, and it has places.
Mm-hmm.
In the first document, we had things like community, we had mission, we had evangelization, and all of these things still also in the works. But here what they're trying to do, I think, is to reach less of a deliberative aspect as much as what they keep referring to as a consensus.
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly does it mean to be a synodal church?
Right.
And part of that, then, is an effort to list concrete proposals okay, if we're going to be a listening church and an accompanying church, what does that mean? So they use hope, what they hope at least will be some blueprints that can be followed by the participants, from everything to creating actual ministries to, and this is one of the keys, heightening lay involvement on all the levels of the church, and that includes then a heightened and significant role for women,
right,
in the life of the church. And then also some structural changes, for example, heightening the power of parish councils that would in many ways require some changes in all likelihood to the code of canon law, which of course can be done.
Mm-hmm.
But these are what strike me as somewhat reduced sets of expectations for the delegates compared to the wide open and very sprawling instrumentum that we had just a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
That we can also note too that this is missing the very cartoonish, somewhat described as garish artwork that accompanied it, and the equally demanding and what some would also describe as garish worksheets that also accompanied the first instrumentum last year.
I wasn't going to mention that, but I'm glad you did. But yes, garish, gauche, whatever you want to describe it, I don't think any of those images were received well across the world. If anything, they unnerved some people, but at least that's a take I got from speaking to people about how they found the imagery. But you're completely right on the fact that the last Instrumentum Laboris was so wide cast that it said everything while seeming to say nothing. And in reality, it was just trying to hit on everything. So there was the language of convergence, that we had to come to a convergence on all of these issues. And then this time around, it seems like there's a real, as you mentioned, sharpening, a real drawing to a focal point. So going back to the committee of the Synod, like you mentioned, the language of convergence has given way to the language of consensus. So in terms of a direction, what are we seeing here?
Yeah, but one thing that we can say, and this is, there are a couple of interesting and very positive developments in this. The first is, I think we can actually say that this is a synodal document,
mm-hmm.
in at least the way that synodality is often described. In other words, I don't think there's any question that the organizers, and I think Pope Francis had a role in this, actually listened to people coming out of last year's synod. Yes, we're still going to have apparently the round tables that became such a meme-worthy event last October. But I think there was also a genuine listening to the delegates themselves who came out of that meeting last year unhappy with some aspects. The first was this idea of people speaking specifically on targeted areas that were of interest to them. This time around, everyone is going to be discussing just this document, not a specific part of it.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, will broaden out some of the conversation and will reduce some, I hope, of the controversy that we had last year, where there were some genuine experts and leaders in the church, I would add a couple of cardinals, who felt that they were being lectured by people who really didn't have a proper understanding of the topics they were discussing. Not to be critical against some of these people, but someone who is extremely young, who does not have the life experience, certainly they can bring to the Synod their perspective, but then to ignore the possible contributions of theologians and church experts of 30, 40 years
mm-hmm.
of life and experience, that's one thing. The other aspect of listening is this idea of moving past these hot-button issues, and
I think they can
be overstated, that this was not the forum because it was never supposed to be the forum. At least that's what everyone was saying. And then they got into the Synod last year, and days of the synodal discussions were spent on what topics of outreach to the LGBTQ community, should the church change her teachings on human sexuality, in particular homosexuality, and then days and days were spent as well, we know, on the topic of the possible ordination of women to the priesthood and certainly to the diaconate.
Yep.
All of that's now gone from this document and apparently gone from these discussions.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're asking about what are some of these concrete things, those are two of the most concrete aspects of what I think we're going to see unfold in October.
Mm. And again, going back to exactly the driving force of the removal of all of those elements in the interest of talking about the synodal process, it's very clear that right now it's not just about understanding what synodal process means, but the enactment and what that looks like. I'm looking at paragraph 67, which was one of those paragraphs that stood out to me. It's speaking about what the synodal church looks like, entailing the whole community, and it says, it's difficult to imagine a more effective way to promote a synodal church than the participation of all in decision-making and taking processes. Now, we want to be clear here. The church is not saying, therefore, we are transforming into a free-for-all democracy. Rather, there's a call for greater active participation of all facets of the body of Christ, including the laity, in terms of the movement, growth, and direction of the church.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there has always been concern that coming out of this, there would be somehow a demolition or a diminution of authority, or a misrepresentation ecclesiologically of authority in the church. And we keep hearing these assurances that this is not looking for the democratization of the church. But what is interesting as you read through this document, how very much it seems to want to reflect the Second Vatican Council.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is the council called for a process of renewal, but one of the hallmarks of the council, in a very true and positive way, was heightening the role of lay people in the life of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that does not come at the expense of authority in the church, but it comes rather at a heightening or raising up of the participation of lay people. And that, I think, has been one of the most welcome developments in the last 50 years. But it has to be done right, and we can't have a misunderstanding of what are the proper roles in the life of the church. And I think that's one of the topics for discussion on the Synod, not, I hope, in a way that confuses or creates misrepresentation of authority,
mm-hmm.
or an incorrect teaching of it, but rather a clarification of this is what lay people can do.
Yep.
I just go back to the rights and responsibilities of lay people in the life of the church that you can read in the Code of Canon Law.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perfect starting point for any of these discussions.
Right, exactly. And it's not just the Code of Canon Law. Even the documents that came out of the Second Vatican Council all emphasize this need for want of a better term, the quote-unquote empowerment or enlivening of the laity in terms of their own participation in ecclesial life. The only way this can canonically move forward into true synodality is when the laity recognizes that their role is to be in support and in frank filial obedience to those who are true members of the magisterial hierarchy. And so this document doesn't seek to negate that. If anything, it's seeking to create more concrete structures wherein that can be enacted and flourished at the level of the local parishes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, for example, we have, what does effective lay involvement actually entail? Well, it can be part of planning. It can be helping the church in proper transparency,
mm-hmm.
In finances, in how the church deals with the ongoing war against clergy sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
We have as well the participation of lay people in audits of diocesan and parish finances. So these are very concrete possibilities, real concrete steps that can be taken. And then when we're talking about the role of women, it isn't this idea that of clericalizing women, which was a term that came into use throughout the Synod last year,
mm-hmm.
in a way that made it clear that quite a few people, if I'm remembering correctly, including Cardinal Robert Prevost, who is the head of the Dicastery for Bishops,
mm-hmm.
warned that that is not what we're talking about. And this focus on the part of those who want to make such dramatic changes to the teachings of the church, for example, the ordination of women to the priesthood, seem to have this almost fundamental misunderstanding of what is being called for in the promotion of women in the life of the church in order
right.
to have them heard more, which is important. What does that mean? It means that you can promote women to positions of authority, as Pope Francis has done over the last 10 years. But again, it isn't to these positions that would entail orders, but it is promoting women to positions of authority where their voices can be heard.
Yep.
And that's one of the points I think that this document wants to make.
Yep. Thank you, Matthew. We will continue this conversation with Dr. Matthew Bunsen about this pivotal document that's come out of the Vatican right now, the Instrumentum Laboris for the Synod on Synodality 2024. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu. This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I must tell you, and from what I observe from very young people, all of these blasphemers, all of these mockers are in for a tough time. Because the devil bites his own tail. And I find among young people a growing reverence and longing for God. I find a decline in the cynicism and skepticism around. Because it had to destroy itself. No one can live on being an enemy of God. It's too crazy. It's too absurd. It's too dark. It's too bleak. God is beautiful. God is holy. Why in the world mock God?
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Christ is the answer. With Father John Ricardo.
I repeat, I'm sure ad nauseum to the guys who are here, a line from Pope Benedict Emeritus now, who used to say over and over again, to be a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, but the result of an event, an encounter, a meeting with the living God in the person of Jesus Christ. This and nothing less is what it means to be a Christian. So we said the new evangelization is new in ardor. That's a kind of old-fashioned word. What in the world is ardor? Ardor is zeal, fervor, passion. Are you passionate about Jesus? Passionate about Jesus? Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him?
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peet, and my guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. We are talking about the Instrumentum Laboris that came out of the Vatican pertaining to the second session of the Synod on Synodality, or the 16th Ordinary General Assembly of the Synod of Bishops. This is taking place in October of this year. So, Matthew, we were talking earlier about what true participation of the laity in light of ecclesiastical hierarchy ought to look like, in light of this synodal process that Pope Francis wants to move us forward on. And one of the things that comes to mind is how somewhere in the document, one of the middle parts of the document, it's spoken of the fact that if the church wants to be welcoming, then accountability and transparency must be at the core of its actions at all levels, not only at the level of authority. And it's very clear that for Pope Francis, if the church is to move forward, any form of veil of secrecy has to be done away with, because that's what enabled a lot of the scandals that broke out in the past two or three decades or so.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We have talked that many of the hot button issues are not going to be discussed.
Mm-hmm.
We've enumerated those already. And yet it is telling that one of the so-called hot button issues that is raised very clearly in this document is the church's response to two things, the financial scandals, but in particular, the clergy sexual abuse crisis. Now, one has to be careful simply seemingly dismissing the clergy sexual abuse crisis as, quote, a hot topic, because this goes well beyond the idea of some topic for conversation. The damage that has been done over the decades by the clergy sexual abuse crisis to the church, to her credibility, cannot be underestimated. It cannot be overestimated either.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the response of the church to the crisis has raised a host of other issues that has opened the door, unfortunately, as we have seen in Germany, for the pretext, at least, for the implementation of this German synodal way that seeks, by using the sex abuse crisis, to unravel so many elements of church teaching, including the idea of priestly celibacy, the church's teachings on homosexuality, and, of course, ordination of women to the priesthood as sort of this panacea, as a solution to the clergy sexual abuse crisis. The instrumentum raises rather the question of the damage done to credibility, but attaches to it in many ways the importance of transparency in what the church does in solving this crisis, which is why I think something like Possessus Lux Mundi, which holds accountable those who are responsible for overseeing the response to the crisis in 2019, was such an important document.
Yes.
He does hold those accountable. And you can see that playing out in this synodal, this document, but I think we'll also see it play out to some degree as it did last year in the discussions of what it means to be a synodal church, because if you are a listening church, you must listen to the victims, which brings us right back to the start of our conversation on the scandal and controversy surrounding Marco Rupnik. But it also requires very frank discussions about what it means to be transparent, what it means to hold yourselves accountable.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. In fact, I'm listening to all of this and realizing that if some of those processes had been implemented maybe three decades ago, then the Marco Rupnik situation might not have happened to the extent that it did. One of the other things, too, that the instrumentum brings up is in the vein of Fratelli Tutti about how the Spirit has, in fact, poured out charisms on the entirety of the church, and all of this is for the common good of the church. And it also highlights the charisms that have been poured out on women. So it remains to be seen what enactment and concrete steps will look like. However, it's very clear that the Holy Father and the committee's decision to move forward is going to involve a kind of active engagement of all people in the church. No longer do we have the opportunity to stay at the sidelines, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. And the instrumentum itself talks about, and this is, it sounds at times like this is very in the weeds type of language, but mm-hmm. as it puts it, further explorations of ministerial and pastoral modalities. Now, some would read that and be filled with anxiety that, okay, are we talking about the diaconate? What are we talking about? And it's a fair question. But as we have seen, Pope Francis has been very clear. I always go back to the very memorable conversation he had with Nora O'Donnell of CBS News when she asked him outright about the ordaining of women to the diaconate.
I loved her reaction to that.
No, yes, exactly. And that was clear enough. So if that's the case, and Pope Francis has very clearly taken off the table any discussion, and the document itself makes it clear that the ordination of women to the diaconate, again, is not on the table, mm-hmm. what then are we talking about? So this exploration, as it says, of ministerial and pastoral modalities is what ministries, what possible pastoral roles can women play in the life of the church that doesn't require the clericalizing of women, but still provides the means for providing badly needed pastoral care all mm-hmm. over the church. And when we think of the suffering church in places like Africa, when we think of the places where pastoral care ministerial needs are so essential, as we saw in the discussions of the Amazonian Synod in 2019, women can play a very important role in that. But if we have an honest and theologically sound discussion about what that can look like, it could prove of immense benefit to the church in the long run.
So thinking about the benefits to the church, one good thing that the Instrumentum does highlight is that in the first cycle, what came out very clearly universally is this strong, dire need for formation in the faith across the world.
Yes.
And the document highlights that. So that's very good that this is something that's being talked about, because as you and I both know, the great gap in catechesis globally is a large contributor to not only the scandals, but also the liturgical and sacramental abuses we're seeing across the world.
Well, that's right. Yeah, isn't it interesting how it always seems to come back to the need for proper formation across the board?
Yeah,
proper formation, preparation of men for the priesthood, proper formation of men and women to the religious life, but then also the tragic malnourishment that has seemed to have accompanied the formation of Catholics over the last decades. The inability of the average Catholic to explain even some of the most basic elements of the faith, let alone go out then and witness them and witness to them in culture, to be living witnesses of what the church teaches.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are, I think, going to be one of the immense tasks of the church in this century. And lay people have to play a massive role in that, not just in living the faith, but then also teaching it and handing it on to the next generations.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that this document really does call. And it's why Pope Francis, I think, sees the necessity of his interpretation in many ways of the new evangelization. We saw that in Evangelii Gaudium,
yeah.
of the church that goes out of herself always to the peripheries. And he talks so often about the poor, but he's also talked very often about the poor in spirit, and we can add to that those who are the poor in formation, who are Catholic, but cannot and do not live the faith as they are called to do.
Right. So, Matthew, just as to put a neat little bow on the conversation on the Instrumentum, we've talked quite a bit at length about it. The document itself admits that it's not going to provide every answer to every question, and it admits the fact that there's an open-ended reality that more proposals will happen in the future as this synodal path and process is enacted and concretely established in churches across the world. So let's have some of your final thoughts on this, and hopefully we can close with a couple more news events.
Yeah. Well, the best way to describe it is I sort of attempted to describe the situation now as three different trains that are moving along three different tracks.
Mm-hmm.
The first is the actual synod that's going to take place in October, and that we're watching before us. We have the blueprint for it. The second is Pope Francis, who will at some point receive the final report, some kind of a final document from the synod. Then the question is what he's going to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, a pope writes an apostolic exhortation. That may very well be the case here. However, Francis may wait for the culmination of that third train. And this is, in some ways, the one that we really need to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the study groups that Pope Francis established in order to deal with the pressing, complex issues that had emerged out of these synodal discussions. Those study groups touch on almost every aspect of the life of the church in the modern world. including the complex moral issues, the question of the role of women in the life of the church, the understanding, proper understanding of the priesthood. All of those are going to be part of the discussion by these study groups. All three of those trains have to converge on the same track at some point. And that's why I think you said something very important, and that is that this is a process that isn't going to end in October. Mm-hmm. It's not going to end in June of 2025 when these study groups ostensibly are going to complete their work. But it is, in fact, going to be an ongoing reality in the life of the church, certainly as envisioned by Pope Francis.
Right. Well, it's going to be hard to pivot from this conversation, but just to touch very briefly for the sake of our listeners, Radio Maria in Nicaragua was shut down by Daniel Ortega's dictatorship under the guise of non-transparent financial operations. So really what we're seeing is a deliberate suffocating of any voice of the church in Nicaragua.
Unfortunately, that's one of my blush reactions when I first saw the news about this was that I was surprised that the Ortega regime hadn't already done this. And what I mean by that is that they have gone to such extravagant, horrendous lengths to oppress the church in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
Already. We have seen the arrest of priests and bishops. We have seen their deportation. We have seen violence against the church from all of the elements of the regime. So this is, in my view, the next step in order to try to silence what is now in the Nicaraguan political life, in Nicaraguan culture, one of the last voices of authentic justice, of the voice of the poor, of the oppressed, of those who are repressed by this regime. And so it was necessary, I think, from Ortega's standpoint, to silence yet another voice crying out and speaking out on behalf of those who are suffering. So we'll have to see. But this should come as no surprise to anyone that this step has been taken. And I continue to worry that even worse is likely to follow.
Yeah, I was just going to say exactly that, because the bishops themselves have not been quiet about this. They're always decrying the arbitrariness of the dictatorial edicts that are coming out of Ortega's office.
Yeah, that's right. Again, this is part and parcel. This is what vile regimes such as that of Nicaragua tend to do. History demonstrates that. The Ortegas have a very long history of dictatorship dating all the way back to the 1980s with the Sandinistas. So again, none of this should come as a surprise, but let's keep everyone in Nicaragua in our prayers.
Yep. Matthew, I also want to say this. You've been a wonderful guest on Cresta in the Afternoon. You've been a friend of Al's and now a friend of mine. And perhaps more than any other guest, you've been most frequent weekly. And we're so excited that you're going to be one of our weekly featured guests on Ave Maria in the Afternoon. We start airing next week.
I'm looking forward to it very much. And we keep Al in our prayers, and I promise you're in mine.
Thank you. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. Stay tuned.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon, premiering July 15th with Dr. Marcus Peter. An engaging take on the church, culture, and current events.
Hi, I'm Marcus Peter. Tune in weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern as we examine the world around us, past and present, through the lens of faith from the heart of the church. So join me in conversation with our guests and call in with your questions.
Tune in starting Monday, July 15th as we navigate the culture on this EWTN radio station. Every year, couples who go on the Ave Maria Radio's Good News Cruise testify how their marriages are revitalized and transformed. Join us on the next Good News Cruise from January 5th to 11th on the Royal Caribbean's Oasis of the Seas. You'll be joined by Father Michael Schmitz, Teresa Tamio, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and many more speakers. Cabins are selling fast, so be sure to book your spot now. Faith and fun on the sea and in the sun. There's no topping that. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Travel tab to find out more.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Rounding off this hour, I want to announce to you that tomorrow will be the last day of the airing of Cresta in the Afternoon. And as we retire this program, we want to hear from you. Al introduced you to innumerable books across his tenure on the air. And we would like to invite you to call in tomorrow with some of the books that made the most impact in your life. What book did Al introduce you to? How did reading it change your life? Or how did hearing about it change your life? So do call in tomorrow. Gear up for that. We want to hear from you. The books that Al introduced to you that shaped your worldview or shaped your life in some way. On Monday, we launch Ave Maria in the Afternoon, and one of the hallmarks of the program is that we will frequently be taking calls from you. So we will always be wanting to hear from you on different topics, and you'll be able to engage with me and whatever guest I have on the air at that time about those particular topics. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.